right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 663. Jason Lingren is with me, and we are delivering part two of the opus magnum, or magnus, something like that, of the Bernays episode that we first introduced last time around in episode 662. In part two, we're going to cover the rest of what Jason wrote, which is very in-depth. Matter of fact, do you want to say anything about the notes you wrote, Jason? They're quite extensive.
Well, very much like I said the first time, Bernays was so ungodly influential, even now, 30 years after his death, he put things in the place, in motion, that just permeate all of Western culture to the point that you are affected by what this man did, probably without even realizing it on a day-to-day basis.
It would be awesome to know how much of this he basically crafted out of his own imagination and how much help he had. You know, in the blog for the last episode, part one, I kept alluding to All in the Family because I thought it was funny because it was a TV show and a song. But the more you look at him, the more you realize it was All in the Family. But did he invent so much of this, or was he getting help? Because at the end of the day, you've got to imagine that what he did has been replicated endlessly by social engineers.
Well, I think he helped put the whole social engineering thing into sharp focus. And they took what he did, used it extensively, and even refined it.
To me, there's no doubt. It worked, and anything that works is going to get copied. But anyhow, if you're ready, let's jump in.
Hollywood has never just been about entertainment. It has been a wonderful tool for psychological operations. Bernays helped shape the film industry into a massive propaganda tool, influencing culture, politics, and consumer behavior. Movies were designed to normalize ideas, reinforce narratives, and create new social norms. Whether it was war propaganda, gender roles, or political messaging, the film industry was a perfect vehicle for mass mind control. This is why Hollywood and government interests have been intertwined from the very beginning. If it is mainstream entertainment, the situation is that it's not just about having fun at a popcorn flick. It's about shaping perception in any number of ways.
I'll take that a step further. It hasn't been about entertainment and popcorn for a while now. They don't make good movies anymore. And I know that's a very general statement, but I'm really not kidding. When my wife and I want to sit down and watch a movie, we know we're not watching anything new. As a matter of fact, it's gotten to the point where the movies we'll tolerate or that we enjoy that are older, we've seen them too many times. So we just don't. But the point I'm making is the entertainment and the popcorn were used in the beginning to get you hooked so that you would come. When you look around at movies now, I mean, you could literally take a frame out of a modern movie and compare it to a frame of an older movie that was shot on real film, that was shot in a real place. And just like Lawrence of Arabia, which I've used so much because it's a great example, one image of that desert, that's a real place filmed with a real analog device. It's capturing something of the actual essence, and it gives a feeling to you. When you come up to now, the colors aren't even real. The people aren't real. And even when they are, they're put into an environment that's not real. And you detect that at some level. And the more that we go down this road, I'm starting to hear people who are cinemaphiles really get disgusted, making clips that say things, are they ever going to make good movies again? It's crazy. And Jason, I know you probably have something to say this because you pay attention to the media.
Well, I could tell you for one thing, if you look at digital anything and compare it to its analog equivalent, it's just so noticeable. For instance, you've been watching that movie Cocoon, which is from the late 80s. The look of that film is so different than anything that comes out today because they just don't shoot on film anymore, at least not hardly at all. Partially because of cost. It is very expensive to shoot on film in comparison to modern digital cameras. But there's so much convenience with the editing and all that, they would never go back to doing film.
Well, there's an underlying truth that most of us overlook. We learn as human beings by example. And most people associate this probably a lot more when you're young. What do? You see something and you copy it. Well, films stand in at a certain level. there's human beings or the representation of a human being doing things. And to make the example, if they put something on film that's shocking, maybe you wouldn't even tolerate that in real life. But when you see it on film, it's shocking. When you see it 1,000 times on film, it's not shocking anymore. In other words, the Overton window is moving right. Not that it's become acceptable, but it's not completely unacceptable anymore. And the longer this goes on and the further the Overton window moves to the right, the more acceptable unacceptable things get to be.
There's a look to film. It's just so different from digital. I suppose some people would say that it doesn't matter or that they actually prefer digital because it's so much crisper and cleaner. But there's a life look to film that I just don't think digital, no matter how many megapixels they can squeeze in there and how many colors and the billions they can get in there, it just doesn't seem to be the same. I definitely prefer the look of film.
Well, there's a whole occult aspect to what we're talking about that we're really not going to go into here. But what do they call a movie screen? It's the silver screen, right? Well, there's a reason for that. Silver, the actual elemental thing, elemental to our world, silver is used in the film process, which is how we got the silver name. And I want to say silver nitrate. I'll probably get it wrong. But in the filming, that's actually there. So even on the occult level, there's an attachment in that old analog method that locks it to the truths of nature, to put it the only way I can think of putting it. But when you see that, there's something below consciousness that probably picks up on it. Even people like Tarantino, who put the most atrocious violence on film, recently made movies where he knew those older movies looked so good because in the opening of his We Hate Eight or whatever that movie was, he used film to try to replicate the old, you know, Lawrence of Arabia's and Dr. Zhivago's, the epic films that had that look and feel with a big piece of film on a wide open natural shot. And so, you know, they're not blind to what we're talking about. And I think it's part of the dumbing down. As we go along, I think film will continue to get worse for as long as they can get away with it. And it's just part of the dumbing down process.
If you really want to see a very good example of the contrast between film and digital, the Star Wars prequels came out when this technology was being pioneered. So the first one, The Phantom Menace, the cameras that George Lucas wanted from Sony weren't ready yet, so he had to shoot episode one on film, and that came out in 1999. So if you look at episode one, that's film. Then for episodes two and three, the cameras were now ready, and he was always a big one for pushing technology in the film industry, so that's what he did. He shot those two big films on these new digital cameras, and you can see the difference. It doesn't look the same, and in my opinion, doesn't look as good.
Yeah, I can't get lost in modern movies. And actually, the truth is, I don't really get lost in movies anymore because of what I've experienced in this lifetime. But I can still get enjoyment. I just can't find it in anything modern. It's all just fugazi. That's the only way I can describe it. It's just man-made, lock, stock, and barrel.
Edward Bernays mastered the art of associating products with deep emotional triggers. A car, for instance, isn't just a machine that gets you places. It's a symbol of power, success, and masculinity. Perfume isn't just a scent. It's desire, attraction, and romance. Every major brand today follows Bernays' formula. Connect a product to a primal emotion, and people will crave it. This is why advertising is so effective, despite most people believing that they are immune to it.
You know, this is the beginning. This is almost like the seeding of the field that will become hypermaterialism. And you're right. You know, look now, when there's a product, it gets tied to a rich person because people want to emulate that. And in this country, not too many years ago, we were a bit odd compared to a lot of other places I've been because the hypermaterialism was so ingrained in the culture. Like, you just weren't cool if you didn't have the Nikes, or the women wanted certain purses. And you can lay that all at the doorstep of the techniques we're talking about.
And the one thing that came about fairly quickly, I'm not exactly sure in what decade, but tying it to sexuality and to sexiness, whether masculine or feminine, became a huge thing for advertising. And now that's the commonplace. Although, with the whole woke thing that's been going on the last decade or so, you'll notice that it's kind of different and they're not using it in the same way anymore. As a matter of fact, a lot of what they do kind of turns people off, funny enough.
Well, that will be normalized too in the generations later that don't remember what the generations now remember. But anyone can go look up, and that was a good example, Jason. Go look up subliminal advertising on an image search from the 1970s. I think, if I remember correctly, it was either the early 80s, late 70s, they made new laws saying you couldn't do this, but they used to airbrush penises or breasts into the imagery of like ice in a glass. But if you do a search on it, you'll see just how far they went to put the subliminal advertisement. And the funny thing is, when they tell you, here's a picture of a cup of booze with ice in it, and the word sex is in there, you'll have to search for it most of the time. But your subliminal mind just picks right up on it. And that's a telling, telling thing.
They also got scolded for doing it in things like movie theaters where they'd put a little frame in like drink Coca-Cola or you're hungry or something like that to try and sell more snacks at the concession stand.
Absolutely. The prime example there was they took a picture of a penis and they put it on one frame. I think you can look this up. And in a movie theater, they ran tests and it had an absolute effect. So most of the time, the frames are going by it. I think back then, 24 frames a second, maybe. So one frame in 24 had a lewd image and your subconscious caught it and they proved it. If I'm not mistaken, you can look up that example. It was pretty famous years ago.
Yeah, 24 frames a second is still standard for the most part for films and things like that. Video, like what you see on YouTube, is generally 30 frames a second. But if you're going for like a hyper resolution look, you can do 48 frames or 60 frames, but it definitely has a different look. If you want the very normal looking, what we're used to, kind of emulating film look, 24 frames a second is still considered the standard. So what they would do is, that's really fast. That gets you that motion blur and all that. If they're inserting one frame out of 24 frames in that 1 second, well, you're not picking up on it consciously, but your subconscious most certainly is.
Right, which is absolutely what they proved. And here's another weird thing too. Everyone listening familiar with noir, there's a genre of film called noir. It's typically black and white and gritty, like old Bogart movies or something. It's a classification you can look up. But if you go look at those old movies, you'll always see shadows. Now look at modern film, the digital stuff they're making now. You almost never see a shadow. And that's a weird thing because in real life, we see shadows. And that's another reason why I like the older frame rate, because as Jason mentioned, you do get that blur and it feels more organic. When you get up to 60 frames or 120 frames in digital everything, everything is crisp and sharp and it just doesn't hit home for me. It just feels very synthetic.
No, the way we see as humans, we see motion blur. So 24 frames per second being shot on film looks more like how we see things. We don't see in a hyper reality. We see things kind of smeared almost, you could say.
It would be interesting to take a look at how many modern movies don't have any shadows. I wonder if that's a thing, but I've noticed it.
I hadn't really thought about it, but because so much stuff is shot on green screen or augmented with CGI in some way, shape, or form, I'm sure that gets lost along the way.
Well, you know, shadows have a lot to do with how we perceive depth and motion. But anyhow, let's move along.
Bernays understood that if you control the news, you control reality. He worked closely with major newspapers, magazines, and radio stations to ensure that certain narratives dominated public discourse. The concept of a free press, whatever it may have been at the inception of the United States, is now almost totally an illusion. What we call news is often carefully curated propaganda that is designed to reinforce corporate and political agendas. This is why certain stories get endless coverage, while others will disappear or get very little coverage. The actual truth isn't a concern. What matters is the pushing of the desired perception.
So I'll make a prediction about this year. I think this year we are going to see an increase in the implementation of AI imagery. In other words, portraying things as if they existed that don't exist. And further, that's going to have an effect on all of us, because it's just going to make us question more and more, to the point where we just begin to say nothing's real. And when that begins to happen, loneliness is going to set in. It's already happened to us. Have you noticed how hard it is to interact with people now? It's getting to the point where a lot of people, even people I know, don't really want to go out and do things around other people, because it is getting so difficult to interact with people. And this is part of the effect I'm talking about. And I imagine by summertime this year in 2026, there will be a lot more AI-induced, whatever you want to call it, neuropathy or whatever the proper term is, being pushed on us all. And by the way, I see it now, and I'm not going to get into this, but some of the big news events that are based on a video, it was an AI video, although I'm not going to go down that tangent right now.
There's a little test that I do quite often, and that's that I'll smile at random people when I'm out and about. And it's kind of sad and pretty pathetic how many people just have a glazed over look in their eyes.
You know, we could walk through life. We should get a t-shirt with that one paragraph I pull from Michael Hoffman all the time, because it is literally the best description I've ever read of what's being done to us. And the loneliness is real, and the isolation and the self-isolation is real. And when the outside world, you know, it reminds me of the movie Ready Player One. You know, what's the message in the beginning of that? Well, the world outside is so terrible that we're happy to go into this AI and try to find some happiness somewhere. Well, without that big fake world to get into, here we are experiencing those very techniques. And the isolation and how we interact with people, it's already been pushed down the road quite a bit. And I expect in 2026, we're going to see this pushed to an extreme.
Ready Player One has its own interesting propaganda really laced in there, because what was the creator of their massive computer network system obsessed with? He was obsessed with pop culture.
Right. The most interesting people, the coolest people, the smartest people were all those things, because they could remember the actor's name that played Fonzie in Happy Days. In other words, their whole knowledge base and what had value was based on things that really don't have value.
A key part of Bernays' strategy was managing dissent. He realized that you don't have to silence opposition. You just have to control it. He advised corporations and governments to fund and infiltrate resistance movements, ensuring that any opposition never truly threatened power. This is why major protest movements are often co-opted, led astray, or turned into controlled opposition. The best way to neutralize a revolution is to lead it yourself, but be very careful with who you bring on board.
This is why I say don't join groups, because I don't know a way around it. They always get infiltrated. Look what happened to Flat Earth. Look what happened to Tartaria. And by the way, the biggest example there is probably is one we've covered. Look what happened in the 1960s. There was a whole generation of young people that truly wanted to change this world. They were sick of the world they had been handed by their parents and grandparents, the war and everything else that went with it. They were infiltrated. They were drugged out. And the infiltration, a big part of it, was infiltrated by people they loved, because those were the musicians. Not only were they delivering what they cared about, they were steering them in the direction they went, because they loved the music, they listened to the music, but unfortunately, the music was under the thumb of places like Tavistock. And this is the lesson. And to say things like I do, like don't join groups, it's a pretty bleak outlook for a lot of people. I know a lot of people that don't do well if they can't go out and interact. But at the same time, I can't figure out a way around it. The minute you form a group, when you start to do something that matters, if some power out there doesn't like it, it's not that hard to deal with. They just infiltrate it, or they start spreading rumors, or they do any number of things. And as far as I know, there's really no defense to that.
The anti-war movement of the 1960s is the ultimate example of how to take over something and twist it into something else entirely. It's proven that the anti-war movement was organic. It was starting on college campuses and things like that. And then, I don't even know what to say at this point. The way they took it and twisted it and the things that they injected into it. I mean, they literally transformed it into this drugged out nightmare.
That still affects us today, that affects our perception today. Because before that time, drugs were not normal. They were not part of society. They were completely fringe subculture, never going to bump into this in an average lifetime, kind of not part of society. And of all the things we've covered, the psychological operations of social engineering that went on in the 60s was more successful than anything that could be imagined. They broke the family unit, which is true to today, and they normalized drug taking to the point where the pusher now just lives at CVS behind a cash register.
The news has been completely taken over as well. And the thing that they've done that's really clever is they have certain mainstream news programs that lean one way politically, and then they have other ones that lean the other way. And if you are falling into the trap of one of these camps, you'll automatically think, and I've seen this over and over and over again, that the other side, oh, you listen to that news. Well, that's why you're getting your information wrong. Talk about spin and propaganda and control.
And there's a whole occult side too. When we do our episode with Wayne on egregores, if you start to take that bit of thinking and add it into what you're talking about there, it's insane. Because everybody is hearing the same talking points, whether it's red or blue or whatever it is. And this is across millions of minds. And as we know, mind precedes all. And as we know, minds shape our reality. So when injections of non-reality are just fire blasted, you know, widespread across reality, what is the effect of that? Well, look outside your window in 2026. That is the effect.
And it's done in proper Bernays fashion. They tie that you watch the news to an emotion, hubris, and ego, because you're well-informed because you listen to such and such news station and not that other false news station.
I will say, Jason, that I know quite a number of people who got so disgusted with it that they don't watch any news now. And I think that's a big plus. I've heard a number of people tell me how much happier they are, how much more calm it is in their household. So maybe for a minority of people, it's been a benefit to be forced to examine just how absurd it is. But then we have a mass of people that are still being fooled by the mind virus.
Bernays knew that if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it. This is why media, advertising, and political messaging rely on constant repetition. If you hear something over and over again that is coming from a variety of sources, the usual outcome will be that the recipients will start to accept it as reality. This is why certain narratives will dominate headlines for months, why slogans are drilled into public consciousness, and why people defend ideas that they never critically examine. The power of repetition and reinforcement is one of the most effective mind control tactics ever devised, and it is used effectively from advertising Twinkies or to join and be an army of one.
Which doesn't even make sense. Hence, the belief is the enemy of knowing. The crazy thing about this hit me like when YouTube was first starting to come to be. I don't remember the exact year. It had been about a year, I think, that YouTube was around. And I saw someone, I think the clip was called 50 Cities or something like that. And they went and they got the newscast from 50 different cities and took the soundbite that was identical word for word across all of them. And that's where I took the slap in the face and my jaw dropped open because I knew what was going on. But to see it laid out like that hit home, like you can't imagine.
Bernays' work in the 1920s and 1930s got as far as to reach Joseph Goebbels, who became an avid admirer of Bernays and his writings. So when Goebbels became the Minister of Propaganda for the Nazis, he sought to use Bernays' ideas as much as possible. And Bernays found out about this in 1933 from a foreign correspondent for Hearst newspapers, which, of course, shocked him.
Wasn't it one of the Nazis, or was it Bernays, who said, if you repeat a lie long enough, they'll believe it, but something to the effect, the bigger the lie, the more you need to repeat it, something like that?
Yeah, that was Goebbels.
Yeah.
The full quote of that is, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. And that is attributed to him, but apparently there's no historical record that he actually said that anywhere.
I thought Bernays was an American. What's he doing giving the Nazis all the secret sauce?
Well, apparently he was quite appalled when he found out what his work was being used for.
Although I think he did speak the language.
And Bernays was Jewish, but apparently that didn't bother Goebbels enough to not use his work. Continuing on, every modern advertising strategy draws from Bernays' original playbook. The use of psychological triggers, emotional appeals, celebrity endorsements, and product placement are all standard practice today and have been for decades. Whether it's horrible for you fast food, useless luxury brands, or pill-shoving pharmaceutical commercials, the goal is always the same: manipulate human behavior without the humans ever realizing it. Bernays' legacy is everywhere, shaping how the masses shop, think, and define what is success.
You know, if you go back to the early days of black and white TV, they would have a show that would, in the beginning, introduce the advertiser who made the show possible. Then during the show, they'd take a break and they'd say, look, this is Jif peanut butter or whatever it was. And when you see it now, it seems quite trite and ridiculous, but it's way more honest than what they're doing now. And, you know, that's what I take away from it. I used to look at that and think, this is ridiculous, but it's honest. At least they're putting right in your face what they're doing and telling you who's paying for it. Now we don't have any of those benefits. And half the time, we're being affected in ways we're not even aware of.
They made fun of that in the Truman Show, if you recall.
Yep.
That
yep.
His wife, or whatever she was, turns to the camera and has a product. It was like a drink mix or something like that. And he's looking at her like, what are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? Like,
no, they slotted that perfectly because the conversation was starting to get heated up and she didn't know what to do. So she went straight to the advertising. It was classic. Good movie.
And pharmaceutical companies, they're really bad about this. Every pharmaceutical commercial you'll see has people just happy and smiling and walking around in the bright daylight. And then at the very end, they have the massive list of complications and side effects that could come along with taking the medication. It's just preposterous.
I almost wanted to do a show around that. It's gotten to the point now where the side effects listed even include death sometimes. And it blows my mind that anyone would hear these lists of side effects and have anything to do with it. But on top of that, they're always saying, well, ask your doctor if this is good for you. You know, isn't it your doctor supposed to be telling you what's good for you? It's gone beyond, you know, ridiculous. When they list death as a side effect in the open, you can tell we're kind of through the looking glass.
I would really like to see a day where pharmaceutical companies are no longer allowed that kind of advertising because it's just too manipulative.
I'm a firm believer that that day will come. How many of us get there, I don't know, and how long in the future, I don't know, but I am certain that day will come. This can only go so far.
Well, right now, they pour so much money into not just television programming, but news organizations. Do you know the amount of funding that companies like Pfizer give to, I don't know off the top of my head, like CNN or any of them? You always find out because a journalist might actually try and be a journalist and do a news story and like, no, you can't do that because it makes our major sponsor and the tens of millions of dollars look bad. And no, you can't do that. Bernays saw television as the ultimate tool for mass persuasion. Unlike newspapers or radio, TV combined moving images, sound, and storytelling into a hypnotic experience. There's a very good reason it is called television programming. People don't just watch television, they absorb it. This is expanded into other media as well, like YouTube channels. Television has been used as the primary vehicle for cultural shifts, political narratives, and mass conformity for decades. And it probably will be for many years to come in whatever form it may shift into as the technology continues to progress.
I firmly accept that as television was about to be a thing. They knew absolutely the power of what they had. It is my point of view that if we go all the way back before supposed radio, when theater was the thing, that they had already recognized how powerful what you put in a play with groups of people watching can be. So when they came to radio, they knew they had some rocket sauce. And when they came to TV, they knew that rocket sauce was supercharged because it wasn't just visual. It wasn't just audio, and it wasn't just local. It was everywhere and all of the above. And I think in one of our really old shows, I had looked up where the first TV broadcast happened. If I remember correctly, and I'm taking a risk here, it was on 9/11 in one of the Lords in Britain's home or something like that, one of the manors, but it was on 9/11. And to me, the proof is in the pudding there.
And someone might ask, well, what about film? Isn't that more powerful? And I would suggest no, Bernays thought television was, because film, it's a contained experience and you also have to pay and go there to get it. With television, especially if it's a show that's got a hooked audience, it's going to be maybe day after day, if not day after day, week after week. And then you can know that you've got these people hooked on it and throw whatever messaging you want into it, knowing that X amount of people who are dedicated to that show are going to be getting whatever message it is you're trying to push on them.
Right. I think a good example of what you just said, Jason, is maybe like when Star Wars was coming out, it was so hyped up. There were lines around the block, people waiting maybe more than a day in a line to see it, but that doesn't happen very often. But when the Seinfeld episode, the last one on TV came, I will never forget that night. We went out into San Diego and there's a lot of people in San Diego and the streets were empty. And we later put together why it was because Seinfeld was on. And that shows the power right there. And there's the difference between film and television.
Seinfeld is an interesting show. And I never got into it because I've always thought the same thing. This is a show about four kind of crappy people. They aren't very nice. They're kind of selfish and self-centered and all that.
Which no one recognizes, Jason, but that is true. It's absolutely true. The other thing about Seinfeld, which I don't think a lot of people pick up on, is there's typically three storylines going around. And by the way, when I said people don't recognize it, they recognize it now because of the internet and the finale. Back in the day, they didn't really recognize it. After the finale came out, it started to be a talking point because of what was in the finale.
I've never seen the finale, but wasn't the whole plot that it was pointed out to them by the judge they were getting in trouble with, that they are awful people?
Well, it was worse than that, Jason, because the judge at the end of it all, after he tells them they're terrible people, he looks at the audience and implies, and you're all terrible for having watched this and loved these people. He doesn't say it, but if you pay attention to that very end part, to me, that's the implication. But in a typical Seinfeld episode, there are three storylines that intermix going together. And by the way, this was one of the early triggers that let me start to put together what they're doing with television. There's an episode in Seinfeld, I don't know if it's one or two, but they're making fun of the JFK assassination. That should tell you something right out of the gate about what the JFK assassination was, because you don't make fun of a real assassination. And in their world, they turned it into a baseball player and someone spitting and the idea of a game of baseball. And when you tune in enough, it does not take much information to let you know the degree to which what we think is history has been faked. And anytime you see a sitcom making a joke out of something, you should already know that you've been poked in the eye.
Bernays understood that dividing people along identity lines was an effective way to control them. If people are focused on race, gender, or some sort of ideology, they won't unite against real power structures. Modern identity politics is a perfect example of this, which was not a grassroots movement at all, but one that was engineered. The more people are emotionally invested in artificial divisions, the less likely they are to challenge the real systems of control.
You know, while we were just talking about TV and now we're into politics and how it works, I think one of the best examples I can think of is the debate between JFK, who was a character, and Richard Nixon. Well, I guess we could call them all characters, but anyhow, they did a debate for the first time on television. And what was pushed out to the public was JFK looked awesome. He was young. He was handsome. And Richard Nixon sweat. And he lost. And a lot of it was based on the perception. And you can go on YouTube and look up what I'm talking about. And it shows you at that moment how much more shallow the idea became that we're picking a supposed leader here who's going to stand for things we believe in or don't. And it came down to he looked good. And that was the dividing line. And it was because of television.
We'll go back a couple decades earlier with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. If I recall correctly, they tried to hide the fact that he was wheelchair bound, that his health was deteriorating. So a lot of times they just wouldn't show it at all. I'm sure at some point it had become common knowledge, but for a while, I think they tried to just kind of keep that on the down low.
I know for a fact they did that. And I don't know for sure, but I was under the impression that even after that, a lot of people never knew that he was handicapped. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I think I remember. But I know certainly that they used waist up shots and other things to hide the fact, and they were actively trying to conceal that he was handicapped because of the image they wanted to portray.
Right, of course. Why would you do that? Because the president of the United States needs to be seen as strong.
Again, it's shallow. Who cares whether he can walk or he doesn't? Is he doing a good job? You know, that should always be the basis. But of course, that doesn't matter in modern politics.
Bernays pioneered the concept of shifting what is socially acceptable over time. The Overton window refers to the range of ideas that are considered acceptable in public discourse. By gradually introducing radical ideas, you can push society toward a pre-planned outcome with minimal or, ideally, no resistance at all. This is why many concepts that were unthinkable a few decades ago have now become accepted in the mainstream. Like with so many things, the shift was engineered. Just look at the decades of music and the clothing as a perfect example of this idea.
How about Ellen DeGeneres coming on TV and accidentally shouting on a microphone she supposedly didn't know was live, "I'm gay"? At the time she did that, that was not very acceptable in public, but the Overton window has moved very right now. But in my mind, that is the first time I remember media in general putting a stake in the ground, saying we're putting this idea forward and we're heading it towards normalization.
Well, in the 60s and then the 70s, they got just sex overall to be acceptable in media and in society in general. Now, of course, the older folks who were a lot more of a conservative nature were quite appalled by it, but that's how it was done. It took all the way up into the 90s, however, for them to start introducing the normalization of gay sex.
Yeah, they've come a long way since then. If I had to venture a guess, was it maybe mid or late 90s when the Ellen thing happened? And look how they framed it, right? She's supposedly talking to someone in private, but ends up shouting it to the whole room because a microphone is open. If you go back and look, you'll see that is where the Overton window breaks through the ice and starts its path to the right.
And they did start in the 80s, by the way. I actually remember being in middle school and these concepts starting to be talked about, but it still wasn't normalized. As a matter of fact, you had actors who were known to be gay, still keeping that on the down low. But once you get into the 90s, for whatever reason, that was the decade they chose. Okay, now we can normalize this as well.
Right. They started to do it early on, and they did it with things that were beloved in this country. Like, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Brady, the father in the Bradys, was put into the news attached to, I think, AIDS, maybe. Hope I got that right. But that he was put out as being gay. If I remember correctly, Rock Hudson, who was a big macho character, was also used earlier than the Ellen thing. So, yes, there were absolutely runs here and there through film, through entertainment, starting to pave the road for the Overton window.
Well, the actor-comedian Paul Lynde, who was really big in the 60s and 70s, if you looked at him now, you would absolutely know, oh, well, he's gay, the way he acts. But that was never discussed back then. They let him be himself, which was a very flamboyant personality, but it was never brought up, ever.
That's why nobody cared. You know, like Liberace is a good example. Everybody knew, but nobody cared. It wasn't an issue. It wasn't put in your face. It wasn't run through the media mill. It wasn't used as a leveraging tool. It was just a human being playing piano. And that's why we were there in the first place. We didn't care about anything else. You know, the live and let live idea. But that's far from where we've become now, where what you think is the reason for everything that gets done now.
Well, that's the whole issue now. They have to use it as leverage, like victimhood or whatever. Nobody really cares for the most part. I'm sure there's always people who are going to have a problem with something. But for the most part, people are live and let live. Don't shove what you're into in my face, and I won't shove what I'm into in your face. And that's just the way it was. Now, everything's got to be an identity and just harped on over and over and over again. And that's why we're seeing people taking issue with certain aspects of all of this.
You know, up until roughly the 90s, maybe the end of the 90s, my perception is it was a much more live and let live world than it is now, having had to take on board all of the social engineering and everything that's gone on. And as everyone knows, I marked the big dividing line of everything's coming out into the light of day at 9/11. And I really marked the beginning of the modern era push towards 9/11 at 1963 with JFK. There are other examples that people can point to. But to me, these are the big stakes in the ground that show that there's an agenda, that this agenda has an end game, and that end game does not include your freedom or your well-being.
Bernays' methods are not limited to the United States. Governments and corporations worldwide have adopted his strategies for propaganda, marketing, and social engineering. Whether in China, the UK, or the EU, the same psychological manipulation tactics are applied to steer public opinion in predictable ways.
You know, here's the thing about this world, and I've thought about it for so long. Is it possible for decency and goodness to exist in this world when it gets faced by a concerted effort for the opposite of that? And every time I think about it, I think of places like Tibet, where the whole world just watched, as they often do, as a communist country they were calling their enemy, by the way, and much inferior to us then compared to now, were allowed to march over a nation that was basically lived a religion of peace. Over and over and over, I can cite examples where people were just mowed over and everyone watched. And while I know that in a dark room, if I can light a light, that darkness flees from one spark, one light, I also know that it seems to almost be unstoppable when there's a certain number of decency going on and darkness wants to have its way. And while I have to imagine that it can be overcome in the era we're coming through, man, the record's not that great. It's a conundrum.
Well, it was figured out that people the world over pretty much respond the same way. And it doesn't matter where they're from or what color their skin is. Fundamentally, humans react the same way, which is why these techniques would work on anyone.
You know, to me, Jason, I think it comes down to, if the group is large enough that wants decency, then that's where the hope exists. But when that group has been reduced, it's a rough slog for some period of time.
We're coming up to the top of the hour here, but there's something I wanted to mention in regard to film that I forgot to at the time we were on the whole concept of movie making. Bernays intensely disliked the people who ran Hollywood. He actually found them to be incredibly distasteful, which I find incredibly ironic.
I didn't know that, Jason. Where did you pick that? That came up in your research?
Yes.
Wow. I had no idea. Well, he shared a faith with them too, didn't he?
A lot of them, yeah. And my overall point of bringing that up is the things that he instituted, the things that he normalized, could also be looked at as incredibly distasteful. And he viewed these big Hollywood moguls as being incredibly distasteful people. So I don't know, make of that as you will, but it really struck me that he had that point of view, considering the incredible amounts of manipulation that he was doing in his business.
makes you wonder, was it the power they wielded that he didn't like, or had they stopped him from doing things he wanted to do?
It was just the business overall. He just did not like Hollywood. He had some dealings with it very early on, but if you go and look at all of his campaigns, he didn't have much to do with it after that.
Well, anyhow, I think we're at the top of the hour. Do you have anything else you want to mention before I wrap up? We take a short break.
Well, we're almost there. We've covered a lot of stuff so far, but there's still more to go. Edward Bernays lived all the way to 103, and he almost to the end didn't stop working. He was definitely still working to some degree throughout his 90s because he really just loved what he did. After all, he is considered the father of public relations.
I guess you love what you're good at. It's just too bad what he was good at wasn't helpful for the most of us. Anyhow, that brings episode 663, hour one, to a close. We're going to take a short break, come back for hour two. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and they get access to all the comments and forums. They get access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, covering my older telescope work. They get exclusive access to my current solar work, as well as the still images of the sun that I've made available for people to purchase on the website. Anyhow, I hope to see everyone logged in as a member for hour two. We're going to take a short break, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.